So we're talking about The Lake and the Lost Girl, and it's your first novel, yes?
Yes, it is.
But it's not like your first piece of writing. So no. Tell us a little bit about your journey as a writer.
Well, I started writing when I was young just because it was what I loved. I loved reading. I went to the University of Iowa for my last 2 years of college because of the writing program there. It has a fantastic workshop,
and
it's the oldest in the country. And I went there, and it was incredibly inspiring because of the way that every week there were great writers coming in, and there were workshops of all sorts and an undergraduate program that I was involved in. I went from there to, when I graduated from Iowa, my first job was as a proofreader for a company outside Washington. And then my first real writing gig was as a reporter for the Slidell Daily News.
You were a police beat.
Reporter.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
It was interesting to kind of jump into that world. It's quite different, especially then. It was 1982.
Yeah.
And Slidell, Louisiana was a different world than where I was used to, which was the suburbs and then the University of Iowa community.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about story. I learned a lot about what was under the surface of life. It was when you're digging into the stories of people in a community in a small town, it was quite an awakening to me about all that's going on, I guess you could say.
We tend to know our own little bubble.
Right.
And then, yeah, I've experienced that too, where it's like, oh my gosh, this is happening in my town?
Yeah.
Now, how does that transfer journalism to creative writing?
Well, another piece that was extremely important in the journalism work was coming to the core of the story quickly and writing in a lean way. And it really wasn't something that I did very long, but I learned it's a really important lesson.
Yeah.
To figure out that people might not want to hear as much rumination or lyrical description as you might have, you know, in your mind, mm-hmm. and to come more quickly to the things that matter.
Was that refreshing in writing a novel that you can kind of unleash that imagination a little bit, get those adjectives in there, get a little poetic?
I think that's true. Yes, there was a combination and a balance. I wrote four different. I've written four full length manuscripts. This is the first one I've brought to the point where I wanted to find an agent and get it published. And then when I did find an agent, I worked a lot on revising with her. So I was still kind of pulling back some of my development of thought.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily that I was overwriting as much as pulling the plot to the fore more and having it be a tighter suspense than it had been. I deleted quite a few words, I would say about 50,000 words, and then added some scenes from the past in the process. So I was still learning about tightening up the story and focusing on characters that were the most essential. Partly because it was my first novel, so there wasn't as much room for presenting a manuscript that was really large.
I would imagine one of the things that advantages that a journalism brings to creative writing, one is discipline.
Yes.
You can't goof off. You've got a deadline. You better get to it, whether you like it or not. And the other, that the editor is your friend.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And that was something that, and then the editor in yourself becomes important.
So I hate that one. That one's so critical.
Yeah. And you can't have it be present when you're doing the creative flow in the first place. It kind of has to be. I'm learning how to alternate those roles and be not ruthless, but to be clear about retaining what's most important and not necessarily getting distracted by tangents.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that to be really enjoyable. It became as when I was, well, the first draft of The Lake and the Lost Girl was finished several years ago, and I left it in a drawer while I figured out how to end it.
Yeah.
I had ended it, but I didn't like the ending.
Marinating is probably a good thing. Yeah.
So when I did pull it out to revise, it was much easier to see what I wanted and what I didn't, and what life had also taught me things that ended up reframing the way that I ended it. So the process of editing became really enjoyable because I was pulling out things that didn't work.
Let's say I'm asking for a friend. How do you get that inner critic out of the room?
I think that dwelling in the material, dwelling in the minds of the characters, becoming immersed in the flow, I often think of it, I have come to think of it as I will stand outside, so to speak, the flow of creativity and feel doubt and resistance and criticism, and everything sounds flat and stupid. But then there's this energy that you get into, and it's concentration. We all know that feeling. It's the most wonderful feeling when you're in the flow. So I've learned to trust, not I guess I'm getting to trust, but I've learned that when I'm outside of that, I'm going to feel all those things and that criticism, the inner critic and the resistor. That's the worst one, you know, just not wanting to go into. And it's an odd thing, because getting into the flow does require a certain letting go of knowing where you're going. It does require that you give into uncertainty.
So you don't use an outline? Are you kind of an open-ended writer that see where the character takes you?
I am. I have found that sometimes what my process, some projects, the process has been that I will outline a couple of chapters ahead. And certainly I know where I think I'm going in the long run, but it's not a detailed outline. I think that would be really pleasant to have, because you would be able to put aside the doubting part of yourself a little better.
I've always thought, I've never used an outline. I wonder if that's a mistake, because I do end up on tangents, and then that inner critic comes in, and, you know. So I wondered if that would keep me on task. But I resist that, because I've always felt like, I don't want to tell that character where to go. I want to listen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's
it's riskier.
It is riskier. It's more organic.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, when I mentioned putting aside the manuscript and not liking the ending, I hadn't necessarily outlined that. But in my mind, that was where I was going, and that's where I went. And it wasn't organic. It wasn't really what would come from the preceding events that I'd set up. And that was what I had to recognize over time. I mean, after I let it sit for a while, was where would these characters, where would these scenes actually lead?
We've talked about the mechanics really here about writing, but give us a synopsis, a teaser for these listeners who haven't picked it up yet, to make them run to the bookstore.
Well, Mary Stone Walker is a fictional poet that I created who disappeared off of a pier in Michigan in 1939, and her body was never found. And over the years, there's been speculation as to whether she was murdered. Her husband was a temperamental man, but she was also troubled. Did she kill herself? Was she kidnapped? And what our present-day protagonists hope is that she went on to live and write. Frank and Lydia Carroll are a professor of English, Frank is, and Lydia is a romance writer. And they've both been captivated by Mary Stone Walker's life, disappearance, and most of all her poetry for many years. They live in the same small town, a fictional town called White Hill, Michigan, and they have been trying to find her. They've looked for documents, because she was a morphine addict. She hid documents in various places that have been found. So Frank Carroll, the professor of English, has been searching for those. And his obsession has led to a really tense situation. It's led to his family becoming, just on the breaking point, I think you'd say. And the teenage son, Nicholas, has an idea for what he thinks will heal the family. And this ends up bringing it to an explosion point. So that's the essence of what the story is. There are two time frames, two time eras represented.
30s, the 90s, and it moves back and forth. But it's easily followed how it moves back and forth in time. And I saw parallels in Lydia and Mary. I don't know if I was supposed to or not,
but
there was a similarity in that.
Well, certainly. And I think one of the things that drove this story to become what it is the search for voice.
Yeah.
Lydia is a romance writer, but she started out as a poet. She started out as someone who was passionate about language and literature. Not that novelists aren't, or romance writers aren't, but this was something she did to make a living. And meanwhile, she had other types of writing in addition she wanted to do, but she hasn't been able to. Of course, Mary Stone Walker, who is living in the 1930s, had issues that were related to the times, partly.
Yeah.
Certainly poetry was valued more then, but she still was trying to find her way and publish and teach. And she had a world, in her world, it wasn't as easy as she
would've been. A parallel, too, that both of them were dealing with different kinds of domestic violence, and Nicholas, the son, as well, not necessarily getting punched around, although there was some of that, but emotional abuse, psychological abuse. And it was interesting and painful to watch how they struggled with that.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, because that was a driving force in the creation of the novel. The insidious destruction of emotional abuse is something that I find to be, well, it's pretty present in our culture. It's present in many, many families, many relationships. And
statistically, it's all over.
Right. And I found it to be maddening, you know, watching this happen with people where their dreams, their sense of self was being sort of corroded from the inside out. And so that's definitely probably the most important thing that gave birth to the novel in the first place, because I wanted to set up something where a family was dealing with that, and then the main perpetrator of that was lost in a fantasy. In this case, his fantasy is about a poet that disappeared in the 1930s and finding her, kind of appropriating her fame, her beauty, and trying to make his life on that. Meanwhile, not appreciating or even treating kindly the people he lived with and allegedly loved.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing, too, that just because somebody's abusive to you doesn't mean you don't love them. And, you know, women especially, I think, you know, struggle with that you still love your abuser, and it becomes a tangled mess.
That's true. It does. And in the case of Mary Stone Walker, in a difficult marriage also, which this was not a diatribe against marriage or anything. There are also heroes in the story that are men. But but in these two particular cases, they did have that in common. And Mary's abuse was mostly emotional and verbal as well, and undercutting her sense of self. The value of her value as a poet or as a person who wanted to be a poet was undercut by that primary relationship. So
that
was important.
Another theme in there was addictions, and not all addictions are substance abuse.
That's right.
And in one case it was, but with Frank, the person that became so obsessed with her, I mean, his addictive behavior with, just ripping apart. I could see in my mind's eye this barn full of ripped up furniture, and I was angry.
I know. Yeah, that is angering, because the addictive mindset can't see beyond it, it feels like. And
there was no reaching him.
No, there wasn't any, especially by that point. I tried to portray that there had been a more receptive person earlier on in the marriage as a younger man, but it was kind of cemented by his obsession and by alcohol. Mm-hmm. There were, as you say, addictions that weren't substance related. And I think that Lydia could be included in that, his wife, because she was in some ways addicted to the version of her marriage and family that she had had. And
kind
not
of codependency,
seeing, not really willing to see until she finally does see what's really happening. And once you see that, it's...
And it's painful to watch the son go through this, too, because he loves his parents. He loves both of them. He's trying to keep the peace and you know, he's... He's taken some hits himself.
Oh, absolutely.
Metaphorically,
definitely. Yeah. And in part because, of course, the 15-year-old mind can't sort through it all, and feels when one of the reasons he comes up with a plan is because he thinks that it's his responsibility to make it work.
Typical.
And I think we see that,
So, some really important stuff there that you touch on. And you've got some upcoming events coming both in the area and out of area. But let's talk a little bit about what you have coming up later in October, in November.
In October, I will be going to the Iowa City Book Festival, where I've been asked to present. That will be on the 14th of October, which is very exciting. I graduated from there, as I said, so it'll
kind
be a thrill
circle
to return.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But the local ones are really going to be fun. That's November 4th, I will be at the Portage Library. Then on the 6th, I will be at Oshtemo Library. And at Oshtemo, their favorite genre, judging by their statistics, is mystery. So I'll be talking there about the development of a story that revolves around a mystery, and that will be really fun.
Oh, wonderful. So these are free and open
They're
to the
free,
general public?
Open to the general public. The times and dates are listed on my website, as well as the websites for the libraries.
And your website is?
JacquelineVincenta.com.
Now, you do some other things besides write, and maybe we can talk about how you arrived in Michigan, and you seem to have developed quite a love for the Great Lakes and lighthouses mm-hmm. and earth care projects and climate change projects. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you come to Michigan, and Michigan got a hold on you?
Oh, it did. I left Houston, Texas with my husband at the time and at the time two children and my stepson also. We came up to Chicago, stayed with relatives, and went around the Great Lakes looking for a place to live, basically. And we ended up choosing Allegan, Michigan. Lived there for, we've lived there, I left in 2004 to come to Kalamazoo. Ah. But Allegan was a charming town that we had a great deal of fundraising our children in. Of course, the lake was prominent in our joy living in this area, going to Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. My husband and I had a business together that was focused on international trade issues, and that's how we made our living for years. And then I moved on to work for, I'm doing some work for a company based in Prague, Skrivanik is the name of the company. And I do translation writing. I write about translation. I unfortunately am not fluent in anything enough to translate, but I write about translation for them, for their American website, for their American blog. And I've done that for the last several years. And the fiction. I also am working, I've worked with nonprofit organizations continuously since I was in Allegan, and I've been involved with two here, Stewards of Kleinstock and Community Organized Regenerative Earth Care. They're focused on the earth, as you mentioned. Community Organized Regenerative Health Care, Earth Care Core, came out of the Kalamazoo Nature Center's Climate Change Coalition initiative a few years ago. And we are now focused on developing permaculture gardens, starting with one on at the Disciples of Christ Church on Winchell, and then we hope to have them throughout the community. So I do some work. I've been facilitating that group for a few years and do some writing around that subject as well.
You do. I was just thinking, you know, some kind of nonfiction book, essays, articles?
Just developing an article right now that I hope to place somewhere that's about the features of a community that we might look at in order to decide whether it's someplace we really ought to be. Because there was a time when we thought about that in terms of simpler issues like how many schools there were and what the arts community was like and what sports teams were there and that kind of thing. And what I'm seeing now is that we have to look at issues that are more complex, perhaps like the locations of nuclear plants or the record of the police department and things like that. It's a different time.
We need you in every community. And I'm glad to see that you're doing that kind of work. That's interesting. Any new projects that you're working on in terms of creative writing?
I'm working on another novel right
now.
You are? Yes. This novel is also set on the shore of Lake Michigan, not because I have many ideas, and I've spent some time in Lithuania as well, that I hope to bring into my creative writing. I've done nonfiction writing on that subject. But this one is set on the lake shore of Lake Michigan, and it's focused around a lighthouse. As you mentioned, I've been involved with lighthouses doing restoration and doing volunteer work at several in Michigan, primarily Big Saba Lighthouse in the Ludington State Park.
So what did you do in Lithuania?
I studied the language. I stayed there three times. I intend to go back. It's a wonderful place, and it's
in
exciting.
In what city? Or?
In Vilnius.
Oh, okay.
I rented an apartment in Vilnius from an American poet.
Oh, wonderful.
Who has a Lithuanian wife and children right downtown in the medieval cobblestone part of Vilnius. And I haven't published anything I've written then but from that experience, but I've written quite a bit that I hope to. It was a wonderful experience. And it's exciting to me to see the rebuilding of that country in the wake of the Soviet
pulling
out.
It was painful at first, exciting now. But there's still a lot of anarchy and political messes to work out. But then who are we to talk?
I know. Maybe it's just more visible there. Yeah.
It's always easier to see it in somebody else.
But you're right. The remnants of the way things worked in the Soviet Union era are still there.
Well, then you'll have to come back and
Oh, thank you. I'd love to.
Yeah, and talk about those things. So thank you so much, Jacqueline, for coming in.
Thank you. It was wonderful to talk with you.